There's a sound that we've all been, many of us here in the state have been hearing with great regularity, the sound of thunder. We'll talk a bit about that today. I'm Larry Mueller, by the way. Our weather guy's back with us, John Martin, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. John, good to see you.
Good to see you, Larry. How you doing?
Good. Steve Ackerman with us as well. He directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at the UW as a professor in that same department as John, Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. So, Steve, good to see you too.
Yeah, great to be here. Love that sound. Not really.
Oh, man. We're going to be talking about why we've been having so much rain in this part of the state. Other parts of the state, there's at least one part of the state where it's pretty dry, and we haven't had a lot of rain. But we'll talk about maybe the weather in Hawaii and hurricanes, and you can join in with your own questions. I hope you will. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. And John, to begin with, in case I got a note from a particular periodical that they wanted you to have a copy of the old Farmer's Almanac.
That encyclopedia of knowledge out already?
I'm presenting you with the 2019.
Oh, man.
So all of the weather information in the Farmer's Almanac is yours now, and you'll apparently be a whole lot better at predicting.
Thank you so much, Larry.
Thank you so much.
So now we know what winter will look like.
Yeah, that's right. Everywhere. Let me just give you a preview. No, I won't give you a preview, but every 7 or 8 days is going to be a big blizzard somewhere in the northeastern U.S. or in the Midwest. It's perfect. When I was a kid, I ate this thing up. Now I do it in another way.
Well, that's yours to keep.
Thank you so much.
And to peruse at your leisure.
I will. There's a lot of good stuff in here. The weather is not good. I've said it a million times.
So what's causing all this terrible weather that we've this rainy weather pattern? And it's really gotten serious.
It's very serious. And it's funny, actually.
I think we should look at the almanac from 2018 and find out what's happened
right
here.
Ironically, I'll say, you know, with the funny sound effect at the beginning, notwithstanding, one of the really interesting things about this, still, I think it's still yet undetermined, if we did set the 24-hour all-time Wisconsin state record for rainfall. Cross Plains had an unofficial measurement as of Tuesday or Wednesday of last week that was 15.3 inches, I think. And that has not, as far as I can tell, been officially recognized at that amount. So anyway, that's still apparently yet to come, or I haven't found the information. However, what I was going to say was that heavy rain that we got on Monday was not accompanied by very much thunder and lightning,
no,
as these things go. And like today and tomorrow, when we get some heavy showers around town, there'll be thunder and lightning, almost incessant, but not on Monday. So that is actually underlies part of the answer to your question, what's going on with this really intense rainfall, which was record amounts for the southern, you know, Dane County and adjoining counties. We had a mid-latitude cyclone come through on Friday, gave us a little bit of rain, and we had a second similar disturbance come through on Sunday night into Monday, and it was able to process unusually high amounts of water vapor and really sit still for a long enough time on Monday to turn it into a remarkable rain event for us.
So, west of Madison, I think, what were the 14 inches?
There were a lot of places over 10 or 12, and then some who were reporting something in the 14-ish, 15-inch range, yeah.
And it just kept coming down. I mean, it was just a hard rain.
Yeah.
Just wouldn't stop.
It wasn't
a
full 24 hours either. You know, let's not forget, last Monday, it didn't start raining till early afternoon. Was it 1 or 2 o'clock?
Right.
Then it stopped about 6, started again, at least in Madison, then started again at 7 or 7:15, and it didn't stop till about 10 or 11. And it was like a freight train outside with very little thunder and lightning. That was amazing.
Yeah.
Well, we did get some totals of rainfall. Actually, Jill was looking some up.
Oh yeah, looks like, look at this
for me, and the totals just in the last few days for Madison, something like 5 inches of rain.
This is from 17th to the 27th.
Five inches.
5 inches in Madison. Places to the west not as bad since that heavy event, and then places to the east. Port Washington had 9.5. West Bend 7.1. So these are heavy rain events. Yeah, right. Really substantially heavy rain events. Look at that.
And then some more today.
Yeah,
we had
that's
a,
right.
You know, an inch and a half up by our house on the north end of Lake Mendota. So that'll raise lake levels again by a couple inches.
Yeah, and the forecast, I think, for this afternoon into the day tomorrow is for similar amounts across the exact same swath of the southern part of the state.
Yeah.
Inch and a half to two. So some places we'll be able to take it without too much trouble. Other places are not going to be able to take it without much trouble.
Well, I'm sure there are some parts of the state where they wish they'd had a little of that rain because are actually in a dry situation in parts of the north. I think even Door County has had, that may have changed with the recent rain.
Right, yeah.
Recent rains. Well, we have a lot of people with questions for you guys, so I want to get to the phones here. And Mark in Three Lakes, we'll go to you first and then on to Bill. Mark, hi. Thanks for calling.
How do you do? Thank you for taking my call. I'm curious why I hear about all the rain events over the big cities, and I live up in northern Wisconsin, and I kayak, and I'm an outdoors person, and I never hear about them coming up here.
That's a great. I'm sure they happen. I think we're getting a lot of press right now with the storms in the south because of the damage that it's doing to people's property. Because you know, up north, we know they get a lot of rain as well.
And the thing about many areas of northern Wisconsin is they are different. In that a place like Madison or Milwaukee is completely covered with concrete.
Right.
And so, yeah.
And so water has a place to go in a lot of places in the north where there's less population and, you know, less concrete.
That's very true. It's not always, in fact, it's not ever just the total amount of rain. It's also the landscape and the nature of the surface that matters a lot for the impact that kind of heavy precipitation can deliver. And I think you're right, though, that the northern part of the state's been on the dry side, although not like it was several years ago where it was in a drought, but on the dry side. So, it points out how small scale the distribution of these kinds of heavy rains can really be. You can have it 5 inches of rain in Dane County and have less than one a couple of counties north or south of it, and that's not uncommon. It seems to be the case this week.
Thanks again for that call. Bill in St. Germain, it's your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I have a question. Michael Lewis has a new book, The Coming Storm, and I haven't been able to read it because it's an audio book on Amazon exclusively. And he says they're trying to privatize the weather data. Do you know anything about that?
Oh, there's been concerns for a while that we don't go that route. I think there's been more concerns now because they're looking in terms of appointments, administrative appointments, political appointments, the head of AccuWeather, which would oversee the National Weather Service. And he's always been a proponent of the National Weather Service not doing as much, if I could put it that way, so that private industries could pick it up and do the forecasting. So I think that's what initiated that audio book that came out, was the concerns with that appointment. There has been discussions over the years between academia and the government, National Weather Service, and private industries. In terms of, I think the book was called Fair Weather.
It was a pun on words because
they were, you know, there needs to be a balance between the government serving society and making that data available, and then private industry helping to interpret that data for the public. And so there is a balance that needs to be met. Hopefully it does not get privatized. I know I like to tell this story that I was in France a few years ago, and, you know, it was clearly raining out, and I was wondering when it was going to stop. So I fired up, you know, the internet to find a radar and couldn't get one because it was privatized.
Yeah.
And so we certainly don't want to go down that route where people have to pay for every piece of weather data that the taxpayer already pays for.
Right, and we wouldn't really have it privatized in the sense that people, I think. When the Republicans took over the Congress in 1994, that was one of the aims that they wanted to actually push, and I think Congressman Kasich at the time, now governor of Ohio, for whom I have a great amount of respect, he ended up being a real proponent of privatizing the National Weather Service, and it seemed to me to be kind of a kooky idea because they didn't really look under the hood at what sort of things are not possible to privatize. One of them is the aggregation of global weather data and assimilating it into a form that can be used for the prediction models that, that actually are the backbone of our forecasting ability. So I think there's some there's been some step back on that issue. So that's good.
Yeah. And taking data, and private companies can take the data. I think there was somebody from UW, a PhD student I was just reading about, who was looking at different ways to analyze data and actually come up with some ways that might make the forecasting much more accurate.
Yeah, I think
in the short run.
Yeah, what's his name? Who won the competition for long-term forecasting?
Brian Zimmerman.
Right.
Yeah. Brian Zimmerman.
I mean, I think this is one of the great things when we're talking about data sharing now, all kinds of data. But I think looking at weather is the example. We have government taking data, we have private citizens taking data, and we have private industry taking data, and everybody's sharing it. That's really important.
We've been at that since 1870 by international agreement. It's one of the most enviable international examples of cooperation in any science, in any endeavor, is sharing meteorological information. So it's not something we want to compromise. We have a really gloried history about that, and it's paid huge dividends.
Yeah. Bill, thank you so much for calling. Keith in Lake Tomahawk, your turn. Hi, Keith.
Hi. My question is about what I believe is straight line winds. And it would be the first weekend in August is what we got, and it was just a path, maybe a quarter mile wide, but it went through a stretch of about 6 miles. And I'd like to know what really causes such a narrow strip, but to go so long.
Okay.
Well, that sounds like two of the characteristics that I would have my eye on for exactly your diagnosis of straight line winds. Was any of the damage, I'm presuming trees were knocked over and so on, were they all pointing in roughly the same direction?
Yep.
Yeah, that's the third one, because if it's a tornadic storm, they're going to be kind of distributed like matchsticks in sort of a more random pattern. But if it's a straight-line wind, they're all going to be mowed down in the same direction. And what happens usually in these straight-line wind events is that it's a deep thunderstorm that may or may not be tied to the development of the jet stream above, but the jet winds are really strong and they can be transported right down to the ground without any amelioration. They hit the ground at 100 miles per hour and they're in a straight narrow line, just like they are aloft. So that's what you get, a transport of the jet stream to the surface.
Ooh.
That's not good for trees.
No, it's not good for you either if you happen to be out in it.
Seek shelter.
that's for sure. Taking a look at climate and weather today with our weather guys, John Martin and Steve Ackerman from the UW Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve also directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. So here to answer your weather and climate questions or comments, give a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll take a look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store, and then we'll be back. You stay with us. Taking a look at climate and weather with our two weather guys today, John Martin and Steve Ackerman. John, professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Steve directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW and also a member of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. So great to have them along. Questions for them, maybe about climate, maybe about weather, those historic rainfall amounts, perhaps. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org with your questions. And let's take a call. Ketzel in Bayfield, it's your turn. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm actually looking forward to being an atmospheric science student this fall at Madison, so it's awesome to listen to you guys each month.
All right, outstanding.
Yeah.
Make sure you come by and visit us as soon as you get in the building. I'm serious. This is not just PR. Make sure you do it because there's a whole bunch of stuff we do that's informal. We want you to make sure you get involved in that.
For sure. Yeah, I will be there. But I was hoping you guys could talk about how we're getting all of the weather data that we're using, any kind of satellites that are going up, and what we're doing to improve our forecasting and data that we're receiving. I think I heard about a new satellite that was launched recently, the GOES 16 or something like that, and what those new satellites allow us to see or do.
Yeah, the GOES 16 was launched about a year and a half ago and is operational, which means it's available to the public. Recently, we launched GOES, which became GOES 17, which is the duplicate. We need two satellites because the U.S. is so big, one to look at the west coast and one to look at the eastern half of the U.S. GOES 17 is almost about to be operational. There's an issue with the infrared channels, the thermal channels, the one that we need at nighttime to look at the Earth. And so the daytime channels, the ones that rely on reflectance of the sun's energy, are fine. But a couple of the IR channels are having a calibration problem, and folks at SIMS are working on that. And so we hope that that'll be released to the public very soon.
I hope so.
Yeah, we all hope so, because they're great new satellites. I mean, they have much higher spatial resolution, much higher data quality, faster time resolutions. We can do one-minute imagery, and when you have these thunderstorms like we've been having, they're really good for pinpointing where those updrafts are, and that's where the downpours are going to be.
It's like being in outer space when you see this on your screen, this GOES 16 data at the high resolution. It's just remarkable. I can't wait for it, for the big Pacific cyclones that roll into the northwest coast of North America in October, November. I can't wait to see those suckers on this thing.
And I think that each one of those also has a lightning mapper on it as well. And I think lightning mapper has been recently or is about to be publicly available as well, which
great.
Is really good.
That's really nice.
So how do you get to so there's one that you can look at now?
Yep, yeah. So most sites, if you go to our site or AOS's website, aos.wisc.edu or ssec.wisc.edu, both of those will have web pages that display it.
If you go to ours, aos.wisc.edu, go to weather as the first place you go after you land, and then one of the options under weather is radar satellites, and then you can pick from all the ones and sample them all and decide which one you like. But you'll like GOES 16.
They're fun to look at.
Yeah,
they're fun to look at.
Yeah, if you like the weather, you will not be bored.
Yeah.
Ketzel, does that help out?
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. We'll see you in a week or
two.
Yeah,
we'll see you soon, Ketzel. Yeah. Looking forward to meeting you.
All right, let's go to Dave in La Crosse next. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've been looking at the statistics on the California fires, and it looks like with the drought they've had an area burn that's equal to all of Dane County plus all of Milwaukee County already in the last 10 months. And I just wondered what the after effects are of the fires, all the heat and the carbon that are given off and the black dried out soil versus the sunlight reflecting off the smoke downwind. And I just wondered if you have a way of telling how those affect the local weather and the weather downwind.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good question. Two things come to mind. One is, of course, the big thing is air quality as the smoke moves into an area. I know if you've experienced, you can smell the burning, even though maybe it came from Mexico in one of the cases of Wisconsin. After the fires go out, it'll get a little bit hotter in that area because, as you're pointing out, the surface is black. So during the daytime, all that solar energy tends to get absorbed and there's very little transpiration. So it does warm up. Not as much as you might think. And I'm basing that on an experiment that I partook after the 91 Gulf War, where we went to look at the oil fields and tried to look at how the temperature changed in the area. And it wasn't that bad. What's a bigger issue, I think, after the fires stop is after it rains, flooding and mudslides and things like that really get bad. I know after some of the fires in Colorado a couple of years ago, I went up the Poudre River area. I mean, it was after a rainfall, and that river was black, like ink. I mean, there's just so much ash and sediment that falls into it. So it clearly has an impact on wildlife, although every time I talk to a fishing person about, you know, hey, how's the trout fishing? They were just like, yeah, I don't know. I didn't go up there because I just figured. So I don't know what the actual impact is because nobody was fishing it. But
oh, there we go. Dave, thanks a lot for calling. Carrie in Sparta, it's your turn. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. And what we have seen with the Go 16 is a lot more cloud nucleation. And with the weakening magnetosphere, we're getting in a lot more cosmic rays, and that's what caused the nucleation. These instruments are really helpful in watching the lightning patterns and stuff like that. And what we saw this last time down there was what we call an atmosphere compression event, where it just does compress everything out of it that it has. So it is getting worse, and it's going to get worse. The hots are hotter, the dries are drier, the wets are wetter.
Yeah. Yeah, Go 16, in addition to looking at Earth, also has a couple of instruments that look at the sun as well to measure energy that's coming off the sun in order to try and develop space weather type activities and improve the forecasting of space weather.
Yeah, there we go. Carrie, thanks a lot for calling. We have some open lines now. We can get you on pretty quickly. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or email us, and maybe you've got a good weather photo to email us as well at ideas@WPR.org. Hawaii had a hurricane threat this last weekend, and then they did get 30 inches of rain.
Yeah. Some places got 4 feet of rain.
Yeah.
Four feet?
Yeah.
Incredible. So
kind of puts our rain in perspective. That's what
it does. It does. And it also, you know, puts in perspective what kind of impacts a hurricane can have. Yeah. This was a near approach of the center of Lane. It didn't get to be as windy as we sometimes think about on the coast of Florida or the Carolinas, for instance, but doesn't really matter. That's not the only thing that can impact you. And they had a devastating amount of rain on a very mountainous terrain. So really bad news there. I think we will hear about this for probably a couple of weeks to come when we start to hear about more of the real upset.
If I'm not mistaken, we're about, what, halfway through the hurricane season? Seems relatively quiet this year.
Atlantic so far has been pretty quiet. And I think that was one of the forecasts that led the season out. It was going to be a little bit below normal a little bit below normal activity in the Atlantic Basin. So far, that's been the case. Yeah. So.
And how do they know that? I mean, what's...
that's a really good question.
Almanac, the Farmer's Almanac.
Yeah, well, it's maybe a step above that. I don't want to disparage it, but I think there is a little bit of... I'm not going to say hocus pocus, but it's a statistical model that's used to try and make a statement about what the season's going to bring. And there are several different factors that are obviously relevant, and then there are some other ones that don't seem so directly relevant. And so I don't know how they come up with their forecast beyond the fact they used about 12 or 15 sort of predictors, one of them which is the strength of the jet across the eastern part of the Pacific. When that's strong, it's bad for hurricanes. When it's weak, it's good for them in the Atlantic Basin, and that can be tied to El Nino or La Nina.
Yeah, these seasonal forecasts are really tough to do.
They are.
Hurricane season or winter storm season.
They're not easy, and hurricanes are, you know... I think that there's one argument out there, one of our colleagues has, that the tropics actually are hostile to hurricanes. So you need to have a special gap in otherwise hostile conditions to have them develop. And trying to predict gaps in normal conditions is really a hard thing to do.
That's a good way to put it.
You know.
That
and
must be Greg. Is that what?
Yeah, right.
And like Hawaii is typically has been almost immune to
hurricanes. Yeah. What is this, the second or third hurricane since the 1950s in statehood? For Hawaii.
Yeah.
It's the second time they've been visited by a hurricane while they're in a state, while they've been a state. So it's rare. They don't usually get them in that part of the Pacific. That's true.
John, you know, let's turn to tornadoes for a minute, because John in Denmark emailed to ask if this has been a quiet, what you might consider a quiet tornado season.
Yeah, it has been quiet. Not just for Wisconsin. I mean, we normally get like two dozen, roughly, maybe 21, something like that. And what have we had? Maybe three or four?
Yeah.
We haven't had that many.
Yep.
And weak ones. And I think overall, that's been the season so far.
I think that's true.
Throughout the U.S.
Yeah.
And Tega emailed to ask if you have any words of wisdom on starting and sustaining meaningful conversations with those who are climate change naysayers.
I think the key word there is start, right?
Yeah. And I think respect for the person, but not for bad ideas is a fair thing to say. I think that's the way that I try to engage people who want to converse about this with me. And I try not to be an ideologue. I try to present them with a piece of evidence that's pretty hard to refute. And then if the ideas get a little bit crazy, I'm too old to put up with it anymore, to be honest with you. That's how I feel. I am. I just say, you know, that idea is not testable. You're talking about something that's not accurate, and you have to reevaluate that.
So what's a fact that you would, in that sort of situation, that you would trot out?
My favorite one is based on research that I stumbled into a few years ago, and that is if you calculate the aerial extent of the cold air below a certain threshold temperature, about a mile above the ground, which you can observe with, I can't observe it myself, but with the international agreements of data sharing in meteorology, we can measure where the minus 5 degrees C, 23 degree Fahrenheit air is about a mile above the ground. What's the boundary of it? And I can measure the aerial extent of that every day in the wintertime. I can do it anytime I want, but in the winter in particular. That has systematically been shrinking since 1948. And it's in the data.
And by shrinking, you mean?
It's getting smaller on the seasonal average. So the northern hemisphere doesn't get as cold by that measure today than it did in 1948. And the decrease in that aerial extent, so the warming, has been systematic. It hasn't been starts and stops. It's been continuous and systematic. And that's an easy thing to show on a map, and it's an easy thing to convey to somebody and say, how do you explain it? Except that the atmosphere is retaining more infrared energy and warming up the edges of what used to be the boundary of that cold air. That's the answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's my favorite one.
Well, Terry in La Crescent, Minnesota has something for us. Let's go there. Terry, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. GOES 16 has a high-intensity radiation sensor on it. Is that one of the instruments that gives you information about the sun?
Yeah, that's looking at the sun. They look at it at UV wavelengths and X-ray wavelengths. And the idea there is to better predict, you know, solar flares that come out. So they using that data and then trying to model it, much like we do with the atmosphere, Earth's atmosphere.
Yeah. Does that help out?
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. And let's go to Chris in Madison. Chris, hello.
Well, howdy. I'm always glad when new weather guys come on.
So are we.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
The question I have has to do with just measuring water. You say there are 14 inches here or there. I wonder if you can set a container up that's just a cylinder, has no tapered wall, whether it's 3 feet in diameter or 1 inch in diameter. Does the measurement end up being the same? Yeah, I guess it's a twofold question I have of you. That's only the first half of it.
Yeah.
I'm sure. Yeah.
One of the things that most gauges have is a little bit wider mouth at the top than at the bottom. Or at the, they're not, you know, you have a 1 inch diameter
funnel.
Cylinder, you might have a, yeah, you have a funnel, so it's a funnel shape. And that's to allow for the fact that the rain may come in at an angle and not just fall straight down. And so you collect a little bit more. Now, if you do that, if you have a funnel shaped gauge, you have to account for the area at the top and convert that amount of rain falling through that area into your gauge underneath. So that's always taken care of in a well-defined, well-constructed instrument. But, yeah, you could use something as simple as that as long as you put it in the right place. The exposure is really the key thing. People always laugh at me. I tell them I don't have a rain gauge because I have too many trees in the backyard, and it's a small backyard. But I'd get water dripping off trees and all that. My exposure is terrible, so I can't really do it. So if you have a big open spot in your backyard, you can use just about anything. Especially a cylinder will be useful to make a reasonable measurement of the rain at your location.
And it's always good to then calibrate that against somebody else's rain gauge
that's
been carefully calibrated.
Yeah, especially if it's really close to you, then you'll get a good idea.
So my 5-gallon pail that I've got sitting out on the driveway?
If you are religious about making sure it has nothing in it when you start the day, it should still give you a pretty decent measurement, yeah.
Well I've just been leaving it in there.
It gives you three measurements, right? One is, oh, it didn't rain. Two is like, oh, yeah, it didn't rain. And then the third is like, holy mackerel.
Yeah, right.
It's overflowing.
And, you know, the bigger the basin, the more apt it is to evaporate. So you want to make sure you minimize the possibility for evaporation. That's why the funnel ones are really the best, because they have such a small little area where the water actually goes in. But and it doesn't evaporate so much.
Well, my 5-gallon pail is about half full now.
That sounds like a big rain.
Oh, man. Chris, thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Dave in Toma. Excuse me. Hi, Dave.
Yeah. I just had a real simple question. I thought that storms in the Pacific were called typhoons.
Yep.
And in the Atlantic were called hurricanes.
Yep.
That's true.
And they're both what we call tropical cyclones. We just named them hurricanes in the Atlantic and typhoons in the Pacific. And in down by Australia, they call them...
Willy Willies. And I think there might also be... I think the Pacific is so vast that in the Western Hemisphere part of the Pacific, I think they're still called hurricanes.
Hurricanes,
when they're off the
true.
Coast of Mexico, they're hurricanes, and of course,
that's
Hurricane
right.
Lane. But
yeah.
as soon as it crosses the dateline, and that doesn't usually happen, usually those storms develop already in the Eastern Hemisphere. They'll be called typhoons.
Yeah, good point.
Now, why do we call them typhoons there?
That's
we have
just
no idea.
It's more of a regional word. No, it comes from a word. Japanese or a
where
Chinese word.
Japanese
I think
word.
It's a Japanese word for divine, for a strong wind or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, they have a. It has a.
There's a reason.
It has a an origin in that region. Yeah. Yeah, and hurricane does too. That was a Caribbean word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. There we go, Dave. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Ron in La Crosse now. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, I was just looking at a website. This morning on my laptop, it's called the Wisconsin Initiative for Climate Change. And it had a lot of interesting, a couple interesting maps showing for a given level of emissions, carbon emissions, how much our precipitation, our temperature change over, say, the next 50 years or
yeah.
so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's quite informative. Of course, it's based on a specific model, but they have legend for climate models. I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah, it's the Wisconsin Initiative for Climate Change Impacts. Is that right,
yeah.
Ron? Yeah, Wiki. That's been in existence now for maybe a little more than 10 years,
I think, about a decade.
Yeah, one of our colleagues, Professor Dan Vimont's been a really major motivating force in that group, and they've done a lot of really interesting things, and they take the perspective of, hey, we know this is already happening, and we can reasonably make sense of how and why it's happening. So let's put these ideas into a numerical forecast model and make predictions about how will the state of Wisconsin feel these impacts as the decades tick by. And so that's what they're doing for you. It's really very interesting work.
Yeah. And they don't just do predictions as well. They look at the data and what the data's been telling us over
yeah,
the last 100
right.
years or so, which
right.
is also really interesting.
It is, indeed.
And how do we find that again? It's at...
I think if you search Wiki...
Wiki.
Yeah, WICCI.
WICCI. There we go. Thanks so much for calling, Ron. Appreciate your call. Jim and Spooner wondered why the Weather Service doesn't count straight line winds and microbursts the same way as a tornado, even though they're just as damaging.
Just because they're different phenomena. So we like to try and make sure we're talking about these things as specifically different physical phenomena. The damage they may bring can be identical, no question about it. That's a very good point. And probably the insurance companies don't care. But the meteorologists want to distinguish them because that will tell us something about where they came from.
And is a severe storm based on wind speed as well, not just tornado?
I think yes.
Yeah, so it would pick up the straight line winds and
or the tornado.
Microbursts.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
Why are... Well, we're about halfway through the, we're almost through the whole summer season. How did the summer shape up temperature-wise?
I don't think I've done a review of that. I think July was just a little bit above normal, fraction of a
right,
degree,
yeah,
I think,
not
right?
Bad. I mean, clearly it's going to come above normal precipitation-wise.
Yeah, I think I think it's pretty right. well above that. That's true. And I think June was also not exceptionally warm, but it wasn't below normal,
yeah.
I don't think. So I think it would be close to normal temperature-wise, but not close to normal precipitation-wise.
And what are they predicting for the coming fall? Are there any predictors out there for that?
Last I looked, which was like 2-3 weeks ago, it was sort of like it could be one way or the other. I think they're still looking at probably a warmer, but precipitation-wise, there's no large-scale forcing mechanism to drive that statistic.
Then one of the things that matters is what happens in the far western Pacific for tropical cyclones, because when they start getting revved up in September into October and November, they have a big impact on the way the flow evolves over the Pacific Basin and western North America. And as soon as you hit western North America, you start to impact the central part of the Great Lakes States region. Yeah. So that'll be interesting to watch.
And what does the Farmer's Almanac tell us about
Christmas time this year.
I think it says useful with a pleasant degree of humor. So.
And that's a quote, isn't it?
Oh, John and Steve, always a pleasure. Read the Farmer's Almanac carefully, John.
I'll have it in bullet point form for you in September. That's a promise.
These guys will be back on September 24th, and we will do it all over again. John Martin and Steve Ackerman, they're both professors in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW. Steve also directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. And they'll be back September 24th. We'll do it all over again. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk with veterinarian Sandy Sawchuk and David Vail about cancer in companion animals. So I hope you can join us for that. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.